Before we get into today's episode, I want to share a timely free resource with you. When you look at the headlines, war, instability, constant talk about the end times, it's easy to feel anxious or unsure what to think. But the Bible offers a better way. Our short guide, Watchful, Not Worried, End Times, the Second Coming, and How to Read the News with Biblical Hope, will help you understand what Scripture really says about the end times, so you can live with clarity, hope, and confidence instead of fear. You'll discover how to read the news through the lens of Scripture, avoid speculation, and stay grounded in God's bigger story. Download your free copy today at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources.
If you follow Jesus, you're already doing God's work, not just on Sundays or in church, but in those emails and financial reports, at kitchen tables or on the school run. I'm pastor and author Tom Nelson, and in my new podcast, God's Work, we're going to completely change how you think about your job. So step into my office for some weekly workplace wisdom. Search God's Work with Tom Nelson on Premiere Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And we're pleased to say we've got a guest on the show today, which is Naomi Fox. Hi, Naomi. How are you doing today?
Hi, good, thanks, Tim. Lovely to be here with you guys.
Would you mind introducing yourself for those who may not have come across you before? Who are you? What do you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm Naomi. I'm a paediatric occupational therapist by training, and I'm the founder of Growing Hope, is currently what I'm doing. So Growing Hope is a charity that champions accessibility and provides free therapy for children and young people with additional needs in partnership with churches all across the UK.
Fantastic. And we are indeed here to talk a little bit about Growing Hope and some of the bigger sector that part of your work is involved in. I have a bit of an interest here. We used to be part of the same church back in London, which is where Growing Hope was kind of born. Would you mind just sketching out the story that takes us back about 10 years to how you, as kind of a lonely OT, kind of had the vision for this and how it's grown since then?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you said, I was an OT kind of working initially in the NHS, and then I actually worked in private practice whilst I was doing some studying. And whilst I was doing that, I spent some time working in Thailand and India. And in both places, what I really saw was the local church responding to the need of children with additional needs. So I was able to step into, in those settings, I was able to go as an occupational therapist and offer support for families. And the local church there were always also offering support to those families. I came back to the UK thinking, why the church has historically been so involved in healthcare, why are we not doing that actually here in the UK? And had a vision for what that could look like. I went to Pete in our church and said, I feel like this is something God's asking me to do. Actually, as the church, we could step in this gap and offer free therapy for children with additional needs, and do it in a way that shares Jesus and also enables OT and therapy to make a difference to the lives of children and young people. And that happened alongside I was working in this private practice because of the studying I was doing, and I had a family who had bailiffs knocking on their door, and they still came and paid for private therapy. And the level of desperation that I saw in families was just extreme. And I was like, actually, we want to be this voice of hope. We want to be able to bridge the gap. And now we know that it's even more significant. So currently, 1 in 5 children in the education system now are reported as having additional needs, which impacts their day-to-day life.
Wow.
It's interesting, this kind of the fact that the church, as you say, historically, the church have always been involved with caring for those who are most needy in the community, and right back to the early church, caring for abandoned babies and orphans and all that. It's remarkable work. Why do you think it was that in the UK this had kind of dropped out of most people's, most Christians and most church leaders. It had dropped out of their consciousness.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think because we're so privileged in the UK to have the NHS and have free healthcare services, that almost, you know, then responsibility is kind of probably on a subconscious level passed to that other entity, and almost we don't think, oh, we could be the hands and feet here in this situation, as well as to be able to meet a spiritual need. And I think for me, you know, it was seeing that level of desperation for families and thinking, I'd come across Christian healthcare professionals all the time in my church life and in conversations with people. I'd think, why can we not be doing this within church? Because actually it can make such a big difference. And I think the amazing privilege that we have as a charity, which has now, you know, grown quite substantially, but as a charity, is that you can be quite responsive and adaptive, and, you know, it's a smaller ship to sail, which means you're able to really try and pinpoint and bridge that gap in a way that makes a big difference to families. And for me, that was one of the privileges, actually being able to do occupational therapy in the way that I was trained to do it, and that considers all of a child's needs without service restrictions.
And what was the value for you as you saw it in embedding this within the church? Why not just say, look, I'm a Christian with a vision, I'm going to go set up a charity, we'll fundraise, and I'll just provide occupational therapy independently? Why was it important for you that Growing Hope was kind of from the beginning partnered with a congregation of worshipping believers?
Yeah, great question. I think because I really believe a local church can change nations. Like, I feel like God has put us in community in order to be able to, you know, serve. There's that amazing quote, isn't there, that the church is the only organization that exists for the benefit of those outside of it. Like, I think that's what the local church is all about. And I know that in order to reach that local community, it can't just be me on my own. Like, it has to be a community of people. And when I set up, I actually set up the first national charity at the same time, not first national charity, I set up the national charity at the same time as the first local charity in London in King's Cross. And the vision was always around multiplication, actually thinking, you know, this could change the shape of what healthcare looks like if local churches are able to get on board with the resource that they have, and local therapists are able to be equipped, like through us as a national charity, to provide that healthcare support in their local area. This is something that could make a big difference to lots of people.
It reminds me a little, I don't know whether you were inspired at all by the model of the charity Christians Against Poverty, who have this kind of similar focus, completely different focus on anti-poverty work, and particularly debt counselling. But while there are, have long been kind of debt counselling charities nationwide, they have this very particular vision of every kind of Christians Against Poverty centre is allied and funded, or part funded and staffed, part staffed by people from a local church, which has been, again, remarkably successful and has grown. Have I drawn a relevant parallel for you there? Was that in your thinking?
Yeah, I looked at lots of charities like CAP, like Christians Against Poverty, other charities that do similar things, thinking actually, you know, because the church also is an effective vehicle to roll out, but also for me, the main thing was I wanted to be Christian. Like, I believe that Jesus brings hope in people's lives, and that underpins everything that we do at Growing Hope. And actually partnering so strongly with a local church means that part of what we're doing is families come into that local church space to use the clinic spaces in the church, and whoever leads that clinic works on a Sunday, the idea being that they can enable church to be more accessible, but we enable families to have already made that step into the building to have the chance to come back and you know, hear more about Jesus and like find the hope that God can bring in their lives.
I think one of the great insights of Christianity is this kind of very holistic vision, isn't it? That, yeah. That the problem with the modern world so much is that we're all siloed into particular bits, and particularly in the NHS, you know, you have to stay within your professional areas and professional competence, and I'm not allowed to do this and I have to refer for that, and yeah. And I'm not allowed to talk about faith unless it's been raised already, and so all this kind of stuff. And the wonderful vision of, which goes back again to the original vision of the early church, is that you can deal with every aspect of someone's life. And certainly I've had the privilege, as working as a paediatrician, of caring for many families with children with special needs. And what you see is that it sort of impacts every aspect of their life, doesn't it? It's it's not just about I need some extra physio or I need some, you know, some special equipment or something like that. It's something which affects every aspect of life.
Yeah, 100%. And I think, you know, one of our things as Grow Hope, so we grow hope for children through the provision of these free therapy services, but we also aim to bring hope to families where hope has been lost through isolation or rejection, and as well as share hope in Jesus is the third thing that we do, because we believe he brings hope. But that those families often have so many things going on, just like you're saying. And I think we've, part of what we've done over the years is we've developed a course for parents and carers about what happens when the hopes and dreams change because of their children's needs, called When Dreams Change, and a group for siblings. And we really try and make sure that the family as a whole is completely at the center of what we're doing. And the number of times parents have said to me, oh gosh, I can't believe you're asking me how I am. And I think, of course I'm asking you how you're doing. And I'm sure it's not that that doesn't happen in the NHS, but we've, you know, or in any other healthcare services. It's just that as a charity, we have this unique position to be able to really come alongside people in their journey and in where they're at.
And there's something kind of quite intriguing, quite exciting about the idea that the church acts as this kind of hub Monday to Sunday, 7 days a week. It's, I think we've often, particularly evangelicals, made our faith quite rational and quite cerebral. And the church is fundamentally a place where you come, you receive some teaching from the Bible, you do some worship and some prayer, and then you're sent back out into the rest of the real world. But the idea that a church is a place where you could also come and find therapy for your child, and also come and address your financial crisis, and also come and find people who will befriend you, and any number of other panoply of services, that, as you say, Dad, quite a holistic incarnational view of life to the full. It's not just about providing quote unquote religious services, but the church could be the vehicle, the instrument to which you could address any number of other physical, spiritual, emotional needs that you have.
Yeah, I suppose the challenge is that you often unpick a sort of desperate can of worms, don't you? Once you get below the surface, you know, you discover not only has this is this family really struggling because they've got a child with cerebral palsy, but also there are huge financial problems. They're in huge debt. There's maybe drug and alcohol abuse. There's social deprivation. There's et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's the challenge, isn't it? I mean, you must come across that many times.
Yeah, we come across that really often. And I think that's the other amazing thing of being in the church, like where you're in a church where they are doing CAP, Christians Against Poverty, or they are, you know, running a befriending service. You can really easily connect families in with those other opportunities within that service and really help, you know, within what the church is doing, really help them with everything that's going on. And there's, I mean, there's some really interesting research. It was a long while ago now, but I was at a conference where there was someone talking about some research, a doctor up in Scotland, about poverty and children with additional needs. And so many, it's a really high percentage of families of children with additional needs often are experiencing poverty because of the obvious reasons, but also because, you know, there's more appointments to go to and then parents have to give up work or their child can't stay in school. And I know that's a big part of the picture currently. Like there are a lot of children increasingly who are refusing school because it's not quite working for them, and that means you have parents who are having to give up work. That impacts family income, that impacts parental relationships, family relationships. It's kind of this big picture that can be really challenging for families.
And so when you said when you started Growing Hope, it grew out of this one church in central London, but you already had an idea that it wouldn't just stop there, that you had a national umbrella charity and you wanted this to grow and spread. Could you just pick up the story? How have things kind of grown and spread? I'll be honest, I kind of lost touch with Growing Hope after I moved on from that church a few years ago. But tell me about how it's grown since then.
Yeah, it's been amazing. I mean, God has been so faithful in the journey, which I've been very grateful for. But the vision was to be able to create this national charity that could be this vehicle of support so that other local churches could be like, yep, we'd love to run this healthcare service. Can you enable us to do it? So now we have clinics. There's 9 clinics across the country. So we have one in Broccoli in South London. We've got one in High Wycombe, in Maidstone, Redbridge, York, Solent, Farnham. and oh dear, it's always bad when you start a list. And we've just got Satis in Tunbridge Wells, and then High Wycombe is our ninth one. So that, you know, for those people, anyone who doesn't know the UK, that's we're slowly touching quite a few corners of the UK and have further conversations in place with other places. And I think we've also really grown our national work. So we're really championing accessibility in churches across the UK. We've just we've received at very key moments some significant funding, which has made a really big difference to us being able to grow. And for me, I really feel like we've seen that that's kind of springboarded us to the next level. So part of what we're doing is rolling out accessibility training and accessibility awards for churches, where they can have an audit and have a chance to think about, you know, what does it look like for their church to be accessible to everyone, whatever those additional needs. And when we look at additional needs, we're looking at super wide ranging needs, not just a kind of named disability, but it could be a learning need, physical need, mental health need, undiagnosed need, anything impacting on someone's ability to participate in activity.
So where does the funding come from? What's the mix of and what's your annual turnover, you know, getting down to the nitty-gritty?
Yeah, I mean, this year as a national charity, our annual turnover is likely to be around 800,000.
Wow.
So it's quite high, yeah. And then our local clinics turnover is around 100,000 at a local level. It's significant amounts of money because we're trying to provide healthcare services to a high quality, and therefore we're trying to match the banding that other healthcare professionals of that level would have in other work settings. And that's our primary cost. That we receive funding from churches when we partner with them. We receive a lot of grant funding, and then a lot of which we, you know, continually are kind of pitching for, and then funding from individuals, from major donors, from people who give regularly, through people doing sponsorship events, those kind of things. But kind of all the time we're looking at, you know, how do we continue to maintain sustainable funding? And we have like a consulting line. So we do some consulting that's paid for to help us try and cover the costs of what we're doing.
And why was it important to you that all the therapy is offered free at the point of use to the kind of service users, to use that horrible jargon?
Yeah. Oh, I just really believe that healthcare should be free for everybody, because it's what they need. You know, I really believe that God has made each of us in his image, and that we're all unique and precious, and we all should be seen, heard, and be able to belong. And I really wanted us to be able to give that opportunity to everyone, irrespective of whether they could pay for that service or not. And yeah, we, you know, families do have the chance to give after their therapy if they'd like to, but there's absolutely no pressure for people to do that.
And have you had sort of pushback? What kind of pushback have you had? I mean, I could imagine you could have some Christians are saying, why don't you just focus on telling people about Jesus? Or, you know, or
I've already paid my taxes for this kind of healthcare. Exactly. Why is my church getting involved?
Yeah.
And I suppose you can get other people being very suspicious, and really this is just a con. This is to try to get vulnerable children, you know, into churches so they can then be manipulated and proselytized.
Yeah, exactly. I've had all of those objections before. I was saying to somebody the other day, one of my first schools that I went into, I sat across the room from this SENCO, special education needs and disabilities coordinator for a school. And she said to me, oh, can we just take this Jesus bit off the flyer and then I'll share it with my families? And I said, oh, well, I'm afraid not. Like, you know, that's really core to who we are and what we're doing and why we're doing it. And I think, you know, we've come across various objections like that. I've often been asked, but, you know, the government should be providing this. So why are you doing it? You know, and I think for me, the need is great. And I see the need in the lives of the families that I chat to and encounter on a day to day basis. You know, I had that family, had those bailiffs knocking on the door. And I think the sad reality is that a national service, you know, that is free and is absolutely brilliant, is just always going to be overstretched, particularly because of the growing, increasing need. And that gives an opportunity for us as a church to be like, you know what, we can be hands and feet in this space. And I think, one of the amazing things I love doing is, so I said, we're openly Christian. We believe that Jesus brings hope in people's lives. We offer to pray for everybody who comes to our clinics within their sessions. If they'd like to, there's no pressure. If they don't want to, we make that really clear. But I'd say probably 90%+ of families who we see in our clinics don't haven't even walked into a church before, haven't had any kind of experience of church settings, and 80% ish say yes to prayer. And you know, that is such a privilege that we get to speak hope over families and share Jesus with them, but meet them in their real need and in that moment where they're saying, you know what, we'd love some help with this. And then they come back the next week and say, you won't believe it, like they slept through the night. And you know, and we're like, well, we prayed about it, didn't we? And I feel like I see God answer prayers in amazing ways through the families that we're working with, both through the therapy we're providing, and it's not just OT, it's speech, music therapy, art therapy, counseling, whole range of therapies, but also through the chance to pray.
How do you kind of thread that needle? Because I know there's something that a lot of Christians involved in some kind of social action, for lack of a better kind of umbrella term, they feel very strongly they want to hold on to that, the Christian imperative of why they're doing it. They don't want to be identical to the secular charity down the road that offers the same service. And yet they need to make sure that they're not, as you say, exploiting vulnerable people in their moment of weakness, or saying, you know, you can have this service as long as you come to church or as long as you join our Bible study group. How do you kind of hold that balance where you don't kind of blend in and just become like any other secular provider, but nor do you kind of weaponize the Christianity element of it?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think the key thing is that we're aware of it and we try and communicate really well. So everything that we do is very clear on our website. It's very clear on appointment letters that we are a Christian charity. We are going to offer to pray, but you don't have to if you don't want to. It's not going to impact the service that you are receiving. And we know that as a healthcare professional, like the power dynamic is massive. Like, you know, you're the one they're coming to for help, and if you're saying something, they often want to do what it is that you're asking them to do. So we've just thought very carefully about the wording that we use when we offer people prayer. So we always say to them, you know, we believe Jesus brings hope in people's lives, and I'd love to pray for you if you'd like to, but there's no pressure if you don't want to. Is there anything you'd like to pray about? And that question, is there anything you'd like to pray about, is essentially, it's very easy to be like, no thanks. But also to say, yeah, can you pray for blah, 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 blah. And yeah, you know, we try and just really frame it in a way that helps people have the chance to say no. We also do it at the end of a session so that it's really clear that it's not like part of the therapy. Yeah. It's its own thing.
If you've ever struggled to fully understand the New Testament or explain your faith with confidence, you're not alone. That's exactly why Premier Insight exists and why your support matters right now. When you give today, we'll send you a special thank you gift, the New Testament You Never Knew Bible Study Guide by N.T. Wright. It will help you understand the context, meaning, and story of Scripture more clearly. And your support helps others do the same through programs like this. So please give your best gift today and request your copy. Just go to premierinsight.org/matters-of-life-and-death. Thank you for helping people engage God's word with wisdom and understanding.
If you follow Jesus, you're already doing God's work, not just on Sundays or in church, but in those emails and financial reports, the kitchen tables, or on the school run. I'm pastor and author Tom Nelson. And in my new podcast, God's Work, we're going to completely change how you think about your job. So step into my office for some weekly workplace wisdom. Search God's Work with Tom Nelson on Premiere Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premiere Unbelievable.
So another criticism that you often hear from secular authorities is, look, we live in a multicultural society. There's always the risk of religious conflict and people banging on about Jesus. All you're going to do is you're just going to create hatred, conflict, aggression, violence. You know, we can't do that in this modern society.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting there is that often the individuals that I come across and see in clinics, and lots of many individuals of different faiths to me, often are really open to prayer and open to the way that we're motivated by our faith in the way that we provide our service. And I think there is an increasing recognition by the Charity Commission in the UK, in fact, that faith, Christian and church, you know, other faith organizations as well, but like faith-based organizations make a big difference in terms of social impact within the country. And I think the shift in that understanding and the also recognition of, you know, there isn't enough funding within government services in the UK to cover all the need, and actually there needs to be other organizations who are stepping in the gap, I think does make a big difference to us being able to then be in that space.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely my experience too, that paradoxically, I mean, it's the secularists who worry a lot about that. But actually, people from other faiths, it's very unusual.
Yeah.
And they often, you know, I know with another Christian charity, particularly with Christian Crisis Pregnancy Centres, that sometimes people from other faiths, from Islamic, Hindu, Buddhist faiths, speak out a Christian charity. Because they'd rather speak to someone from a faith background than they would to a secular therapist who thinks it's all rubbish. You know, it's a paradox, isn't it? That what people would imagine would lead to conflict is it's a myth. It's a sort of, I suppose, it comes back from that period in Europe when, you know, religion was the source of all, you know, it was conceived as the source of all violence. And then the Enlightenment says, well, so what we've got to do is downplay all religious differences. But we're in a very different world.
Mm. And that idea of religion, you know, remaining in the private sphere just isn't really credible in the 21st century anymore, when you have, you know, this is going off topic, but, you know, people marching in Trafalgar Square waving crosses at a protest about immigration, or you have a debate about the definition of anti-Islamophobia. You know, like, religion is woven through public life. And I think that kind of slightly naive 20th century idea that you can hive it off and you can just find you to have a faith, but you must keep it in your home and close the door on it and not bring it into your work or into your interaction with others is increasingly recognised as a bit childish, a bit naive. If you're a Christian occupational therapist, like, your faith will influence how you deliver that therapy in the same way that my faith influences how I write journalism.
Mm. Yeah, and what's interesting is, you know, obviously as healthcare professionals, we've got all these guidelines that we have to follow. We have to be above board. We have to be always giving people choice. You know, it's so important not to be, you just can't be ramming your faith down someone's throat. Like, that's not okay and not ethical. And therefore, we've had to really think about how do we do that in a way that really does give people choice, but also how do we communicate clearly who we are as an organisation and what we believe, and then we are allowed to do what we do because we're very clear about it and giving people that basis to understand why we're doing what we're doing.
So I'm really intrigued in in this model that you've got, because one of the things which I'm very concerned about looking in the future is that if, for instance, if some form of assisted suicide, euthanasia, gets legalised within the NHS, there are going to be a lot of Christians within the NHS who are going to find it increasingly difficult to carry on working within the NHS, that it will be seen as a sort of hostile environment if people have strongly held beliefs about human life and so on. So I'm starting to think, you know, is it possible that we're going to have to invent more kinds of independent Christian health care facilities outside the NHS? And I'm just wondering, you know, what you've learned, if, you know, having done this for 10 years, what are the lessons that you've learned about trying to create health facilities working with churches outside the NHS?
Yeah, I've learned a lot, many things in this last bit of time. Yeah, I think well, one of the things we're trying to do is we've created a Christian therapist forum and a kind of healthcare type network for therapists specifically, but also a faith and healthcare conference, which anyone can look at the notes and find out more about that we're running as a charity. But I think we're trying to connect with more healthcare professionals because we can really see that there is, you know, there are many people who are wanting to potentially step out of the sphere of having very tight service restrictions on what they're able to do within their role. I think I've learned, I mean, you know, there are so many important lessons we've learned around governance, around insurance, around, you know, the kind of nitty gritty things that make up what an organisation makes up and needs to be doing. And I think that's why we exist as a national charity, in order to equip the church to enable that to be possible. What I'd say is often, you know, having those structures almost external to the local charity that's delivering it, I think that has been helpful in our case in the way that we've delivered our model, because it means that we can just provide that support and reassurance that we've done the kind of due diligence. I think the key thing is when you're running a healthcare service, you have to be, you know, we've mentioned professional guidelines and those kind of things. You have to be clear that you are going to be able to meet those guidelines and meet the standards that you should be meeting within your context and country and setting. And that will look different in different, you know, different spheres and different organisations. And, you know, we don't do any kind of like medical interventions. So currently we don't need to do CQC inspections, Care Quality Commission, for those of you who know about those. But there are different, you know, I imagine for some people stepping out of NHS services potentially or other services, that would be a really important consideration, you know, which bodies do have to be reported to, and what does that look like? And
because it's really important, isn't it, that if there are kind of parallel Christian healthcare structures, that they're not perceived, or certainly not are in reality, kind of second rate.
Yeah.
The worst thing is if you have, I don't know, imagine some alternative universe where there is a kind of a network of Christian hospitals and clinics, but they're widely seen as rubbish compared to the NHS ones, let alone the other private ones. Like, you want that to be kind of have the exact same kind of excellence and professionalism, rather than them being like, oh, these are the kind of ramshackle, falling down, run by volunteers. It's all charity. It's all a bit dodgy. It's all a bit rubbish.
Yeah, 100%. And that was so important for us when we set up, of like, this has to be a high quality, good healthcare service. And we put in loads of structures in place to, like, you know, our guidelines are very clear about what our service structure looks like, how we do our clinical supervision, how we audit what we're doing, how we record our clinical notes, all of those kind of things, so that we can really make sure that we're providing, like, super high quality. Because you're absolutely right, like, you just it's just so important to do it well.
You talked a little bit earlier about the kind of significant growth that Growing Hope has seen since you started about 10 years ago. Obviously a lot of that is due to prayer and God's blessing on the ministry. Is it also fair to say that you're tapping into, like, a massive unmet need, and that is largely why people are falling over themselves to partner with you and set up centres, and families coming forward? Because there has been this huge rise in the UK, at least, of children who have some kind of additional need.
Yeah, 100%. I think, you know, so it's, I was saying earlier, it's now 1 in 5-ish children in the education system have additional needs. And the anecdotally, children are waiting 1, 2 years, 3 years plus for any kind of diagnoses of meant generally. And then once children get diagnoses, particularly it seems to be particularly of autism, there's often not then much follow-up support. So many children aren't receiving therapy support, and we're trying to be therapists that we provide. It's a one assessment and 6 weeks of intervention that we provide, working on 3 functional goals. So it is a targeted small input. They can come back to us later on, but we're trying to really give families something that they're desperate for in a moment where they really need it. I had a family, I was chatting to someone recently who'd been to their GP with their teenage son, and the thinking, maybe he has autism, maybe that's what's impacting his day-to-day life at the moment. That's why he's having challenges in school and things. And the GP turned around and said, you know what, I'm afraid there's nothing I can do, because to refer here, the waiting list is 4 to 5 years. Your son will be an adult, so I can't help. And you just think, like, it just is awful, really, that's the situation we're in. And I think there's such a calling on us as a church, in my opinion, to be the hands and feet of Jesus, to be a place where everyone can be seen, heard and able to belong, and that really takes that seriously and thinks, you know, we don't just need to be welcoming the people who are similar to us, but what does it look like to extend that welcome to people who perhaps look different to us or have different needs?
What about the international side? Are you aware of anything like this? I mean, you said your original inspiration was in India and Thailand. Are you aware of any models trying to do the same kind of thing?
No, not currently. I mean, we'd happily chat to anyone who wants to kind of replicate the model elsewhere. But yeah, other than what I saw there, where obviously the healthcare systems are very different in Thailand and India, and really there the local church was kind of, you know, the only option for a lot of those families who I was working with, which is what inspired me. But I think there's definitely, room for more of these kind of services that provide this kind of support.
Yeah, it's a challenge, isn't it? I mean, I've closed links with the International Christian Medical and Dental Association. There are Christian medics, certainly, all over the globe. I think the number of Christian therapists is smaller, isn't it? In fact, therapy is, as you know, therapists, it's a smaller group. And in some areas, in low-resource countries, it's still very underdeveloped. But it's a wonderful vision, I think. And if people... What about in this country? You know, if someone's listening to this podcast and is feeling inspired and saying, why can't my church be doing something like this? You know, what are the sort of minimum requirements you would need, you think you need for a church to take on something like this?
I think always reach out, have a conversation with us. You know, we're growinghope.org.uk. Anyone can go on our website, have a look, talk to us. To be honest, it's just about passion and about the church deciding that this is something that they would like to be doing in order to reach their local community. We've got churches we're partnered with of 40, 50 people, and then churches of, you know, hundreds of people. And really the model, you know, we try and bring in other churches in a local area so that we can serve that local area better. So it's not just on one church to deliver that service. But we've always found that God's provided the right people at the right time in the right location. So we're always up for a conversation. And I think some of the things that I was talking about, our When Dreams Change course, our siblings groups, that support parents and carers and brothers and sisters, anyone can run those. We train them to run them in any church community, or often in local schools connected with their local church. So we would love to hear from people about that. And actually, we've had lots of people internationally trained in those courses. So we would happily have conversations about that as well.
There's been a lot of debate about what exactly is behind this huge kind of rise in children diagnosed or identified as having additional needs. Here in the UK, there's been a lot of, the government has been kind of mulling reforms to the system, kind of saying that the kind of spending on services for children is kind of spiraling out of control. I mean, it's in this country, it's largely local councils that spend on that. And in some places, it's kind of 60, 70, 80% of the council's entire budget is going on various kinds of support for children with additional needs. And yet still, children are slipping through the net, not getting the support they need. Do you have a view on, is it a genuine increase, or is it these children always been there? They've just been kind of invisible and underdiagnosed in the past?
It's such a good question. I think it's one that so many people are asking. I think there's definitely an increase in awareness of needs, and that has led to an increase in diagnoses for sure. But it does really feel like there's a kind of increase in needs, you know, whether that's lots of people talk about like the post-COVID generation of where children missed out on some key opportunities that have had an impact on their development. I think one of the things that we find at Growing Hope is that, you know, for some families, actually, there are some really small things we can put in place as therapists or ideas that we can bring to a family that actually do make quite a massive difference to then that child and their outcomes and then potentially the level of support they would need in the future or not. So I think there's a kind of broad spectrum of different reasons. I think, you know, in adults for sure, there's definitely more diagnosis because adults are realizing and understanding more about additional needs and disability and then like, oh, maybe that's something that actually applies to me and that could help me understand myself. And
What would be the sort of intervention you just mentioned, a simple intervention which might actually make quite a difference to a family with a child?
I would often, so I'm an occupational therapist, I'd always talk about regulation. So sensory regulation, the way that we take in and understand the world around us has such a big impact on the way that we're then able to focus and engage in tasks. So for any family that I'm talking to, often I would talk about proprioception, which is about where our body is in space, knowing where our body is in space. But the incredible thing about our brain is that if we receive what we call as occupational therapists heavy work input, so any input that puts pressure through my joints, whether that's jumping up and down on the spot, pushing a wall, chewing or crunching something really hard, giving myself a big hug, you know, sitting on a gym ball, any of that movement activity is going to help me if I'm zoned out and a bit lethargic and can't concentrate, or if I'm bouncing off the walls and jumping up and down. So like that feeling if you go to the gym, your body kind of feels like, oh, okay. You know, that kind of input gives you this sense of like, oh, there's my body. And it can make a really big difference to children, young people and adults being able to focus and engage on tasks. So building that into routine, you know, a bit of jumping on the trampoline before doing homework or having a crunchy snack on the way to school or when you're picked up can make quite a transformative difference to children being able to then engage in day-to-day life.
It's amazing, isn't it? It's kind of the little things that we're increasingly learning about how our bodies and brains interact. I think I've been reading a little bit around things around kind of how trauma can affect the brain, but also how some of the therapies that have been developed for that are, as you say, something as simple as, you know, eye movement and things kind of massage and things like that can somehow be surprisingly beneficial in terms of helping people focus, concentrate, deal with difficult emotions, things like that. I mean, it goes back to that idea about, you know, Christianity being quite holistic. Maybe this shouldn't be a surprise to us, but we've had so many years of this kind of enlightenment separation of our kind of reason and rational thinking from our physical bodies. It still feels quite strange to think that we're all integrated and connected like that.
And there's something about the modern world, isn't there? You know, the sort of world that kids are growing up in, which often operates against that. You know, the sort of hyper-stimulation you get from YouTube and screens and the other, you know, the way modern life works, you know, in urban environments where you don't get a chance to just enjoy the creation and this kind of overprotection, you know, you're not allowed to explore because you might hurt yourself, so you're much safer sitting on your bottom and watching a television. You know, it really doesn't help, does it?
Yeah, no, exactly. And it is so amazing. I think our brains are absolutely fascinating, and I love like learning more about how our brains and our bodies interlink and how that makes a difference to our day-to-day lives. And I think, like you're saying, John, there's just the culturally, there's been such a shift in the way that children are growing up, and you know, like you've said, Tim, there are so many small things that we can do that actually do make such a big difference to how we're able to process and experience and engage in the world. And I think the more we can bring, you know, I'm often saying to schools, like, if we can just shift the timetable slightly and do like movement focus, it will be massive for your children. It doesn't have to be a small, you know, big bit of movement, but actually, you know, that's what I'm always doing in my therapy sessions. It changes something in the way that our brains work and can process information. And that shift, you know, I think there's a kind of desire to see that shift in learning and in how we support children, but often people don't know how to get there.
Can I pick up on that thing we mentioned briefly about the kind of reforms in this country the government is proposing around how children with what's often called SEND, special educational needs and disabilities, are supported and funded? Obviously, we're not a politics podcast, but these things are political. You know, fundamentally, the reason Growing Hope has a long line of people coming out the door is because there is not enough state-funded, taxpayer-funded support available from either your local authority, your council, or from the NHS services. Do you, or does Growing Hope have a kind of view? Do you do any advocacy work? Do you think the church should kind of step into this and pick a side or make a case in how the beyond just simply the kind of provision you're doing, but what the national pitch should look like or how it could be reformed?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we've got some kind of response webinars that we're running at the moment that people can join around what does it look like for us as the church to kind of, you know, like I was saying earlier, try and still bridge that gap, like knowing that the need is massive, knowing that I do really think that everyone's heart is for the children, young people and families. But there are some things that really need clarifying with these new reforms in terms of how they're going to impact families and what that looks like. And I think the church can step in the way that we provide that, like we've been talking about, that more holistic support for individuals where we think about the whole family. And you know, we're so well placed as the church to be a space for community, for families to be able to come and receive support. And so as Growing Hope, we're really trying to equip churches to think about how they can do that, as well as to just be a voice that's asking the questions of, okay, well, what will this mean for families who are experiencing XYZ? And I think there is some hope in the reforms. You know, I think the kind of general picture is that actually more teachers and individuals across the board are going to be equipped in supporting children. And I think if that's able to be delivered, that could make a really big difference as well to families.
I do think politically there is a huge underlying issue. Because I remember, you know, when I was working as a paediatrician, sometimes circling around these issues. And the problem is that babies and children are not voters. And they, although people say nice things about them, you know, everybody says, oh, yeah, God bless them. The little
children
darlings,
are our future.
Yeah. And all that. When push comes to shove, I'm afraid it's my generation, the grey hairs, who are the voters and who... It's elderly people's interests, it's their pensions, it's their, you know, cancer treatments, it's...
House prices,
yeah. Yes. And time and again, I think the NHS, because it responds to public pressure, you know, the real primary focus of so much of the NHS is cancer treatments, you know, new expensive... curative services, you know, we demand it, you know, we need, you know, new treatments for dementia, we want blah, 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 blah. And from a Christian point of view, I just think it's all wrong. You know? Yeah. I mean, our generation, of course, we want justice, we want our fair share, but we don't, it's completely wrong for old people to be sort of putting their greedy mitts on the on everything. Surely we should be saying we need to prioritize our children, you know, that's where they are, our future. And so how to square that circle in a democratic government, I don't know, but it's a big one.
Yeah, I think definitely a big challenge. And I think, you know, there's just so much need, isn't there? And I think that is the challenge that is presenting, is how do you, you know, I think often for the families that we work with as well, there's so much challenge that is going on. And like we're talking about, it's such a complex thing. It's not just the one thing on the surface, it's all the other things underneath. And I think, you know, that is where the church can step in the gap, because it's, there are so many different things that would need to line up in order to be able to support that family in a way that's holistic. And I think that's where, you know, when we're really getting to know people for who they are on an individual level, we can make a big difference. But obviously the fund, you know, if you've got funding to do that, then that makes a big difference. And it would be great to have more of that around so that we can do even more. But
I wonder if there's something there about the church being quite an unusual thing in this current country, which is a kind of radical intergenerational community. And that, and it's not true of all congregations, of course, but at its best, a church should have everyone from, you know, 0 to 100 represented and included. And whether therefore the church's voice can be a way of trying to bridge some of those. Because I think, as you say, Dad, democracy and electoral politics often divides us into different special interest groups each. And you have, you know, the Parents of Additional Needs lobby group, and they're a very well-established lobby group who've got the ear of government and they're calling for their bit. But then you have the pensioners calling for more money for them. And they're not all wrong. Like, everyone could do with more funding. Everyone, you know, everyone could do with more money. But it, rather than pitting people against each other, maybe there's something about the church trying to integrate across difference, both age, gender, but also ethnicity, social class, and saying, is there a, could the church be a voice for a more kind of responsible dialogue about how we distribute our very limited resources among these competing needs, rather than it becoming a bun fight? All right, well, we're running out of time, so let's call it to there. We could talk this for a lot longer, but Naomi, you've got to move on. Thank you so much, Naomi, for coming on to talk to us about Growing Hope and about this bigger picture of how the church can be a place of hope for children and families. If people want to find out more information, where should they go?
They can go to our website, so growinghope.org.uk or at growinghopeuk on most social media options. There's lots more information, and we'll put some links in the show notes as well with our Christian Therapist Forum and Faith and Healthcare Conference and different ways that people can get involved.
Brilliant. I really recommend having a look there, and particularly if you're in the UK or even further afield and you think you could partner with Growing Hope. Brilliant organisation, so please do have a look at that. As always, lots to read and listen to and watch on Dad's website. That's johnwyatt.com. And you can also find some of my journalism on my website, tswyatt.com. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. If you've got anything you'd like to comment on, any conversations you want us to have on this podcast, please get in touch by emailing molad@premier.org.uk. Otherwise, we'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
If you follow Jesus, you're already doing God's work, not just on Sundays or in church, but in those emails and financial reports, the kitchen tables, or on the school run. I'm pastor and author Tom Nelson, and in my new podcast, God's Work, we're going to completely change how you think about your job. So step into my office for some weekly workplace wisdom. Search God's Work with Tom Nelson on Premiere Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.